This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Good morning, and welcome to the Indie Media Show here on RTRFM 92.1, The Sound Alternative. Thanks so much, without further ado, to Jeffrey, who's buried in work. Still, he never stops. He's so devoted to this station and the service of community radio that he's got his head buried in his notes. It's great to see. What a champion, what a servant of the station. And another great addition of On The Record, as always. Thank you so much, Jeff. Pleased to be with you, flying solo in the studio today, which suits me. None of the encumbrances and inconveniences of one Raymond Alfred Grenfell to disturb my train of thought. So that's a welcome relief, as I'm sure the listeners would agree. Now, of course, the big news this morning is all about succession plans, very dramatic news. And I am, of course, referring to the news that the West Coast Eagles are hunting Ken Hinckley as the number one candidate to replace Adam Simpson as coach. So we're going to be devoting ourselves to that very important subject over the course of the next hour. No, seriously, obviously, there's plenty to say about the news, which I think in the end, I don't know about you, listeners, it probably didn't come as a surprise that Biden has stepped down as the Democratic Party presidential candidate in November. Huge pressure. Trickle became a flood is really the dynamic that happened. Pelosi, Obama, backgrounding against him, although not going on the public record. Dozens of congressmen, senators, quietly on teleconference calls and in back rooms urging him to quit, and he stubbornly refused to do so, which is why, and we'll get into this further later on in the show, which is why it's sort of funny seeing some of the obsequious comments by the usual liberal suspects. Probably the worst of them is MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, who said, and I quote, "What a man, what a patriot, what an act of selfless devotion to your country," which obviously is completely at odds with the actual record of events of what happened, which is that he absolutely waited until virtually the very last minute before quitting and has put his party obviously in a very difficult place. And if he was acting selflessly, he would have quit months ago. In fact, there's an argument to say he would have never have run for president in the first place, because those signs of senility have been there for years, not weeks. And everyone's sort of talking about the debate performance, which is, I mean, it's sort of quite strange, actually. It's an example, a demonstration of the way the media works, that suddenly the mainstream media recognises what any person with common sense recognised a long, long time ago, which is he's not fit to serve in public office. But somehow, you know, the media trains us to believe that that fact was only known to the public during the debate performance, which is just nonsense. So any notion that he's acting selflessly is manifestly very, very silly. But we'll get into some of the commentary and around that a little later in the show, and where things might go from here. Obviously, the anointed successor, or it's not a done deal, is Kamala Harris, but there's plenty of water to go under the bridge. As we know, mainstream politics is hardly a predictable game these days, so she's far from being a shoo-in at this stage, Kamala Harris. But look, plenty else to get on with the show. Jeff mentioned the CFMEU. We're going to actually play an interview from the archives. We thought it was a very germane interview to play. You probably have heard talk of the BLF, the Old Builders Labourers Federation, with this huge brouhaha around alleged corruption in the Victorian branch of the construction division of the CFMEU, and references to Bob Hawke in the 1980s. Deregistering the Builders Labourers Federation, which has become the semi-mythical, legendary union. Few people remember the history of that union, and it had its troubles and it had its corruption. There's no question about that, but it also had a glorious history as well, and most famously the history of the green bands in New South Wales. So we thought it apposite and timely, given that the CFMU brouhaha, to bring you an interview with Professor Verity Bergman, who was At the time we interviewed her, adjunct professor of politics in the School of Social Sciences at Monash University and co-author of Green Bands, Red Union, Environmental Activism and the New South Wales Builders Labourers Federation. So really worthwhile, inspiring history to dig into further, actually, if you're interested in environmentalism and the history of radicalism and militant trade unionism in this country. Also going to be speaking shortly to Sam Wainwright from Stop AUKUS WA. There's a big conference coming up later this week that you might not have heard of. It's not getting much publicity. And, you know, we like to cover important things that don't get much publicity in the mainstream media here at the Indie Media Show. The Indian Ocean Defence and Security Conference, a big chinwag, you know, talking shop for basically heads of the military and government and weapons companies all coming together for a lovely little soiree to drink tea and, well, I was going to say eat biscuits. Is probably something more fancy than biscuits caviar, probably, isn't it? But a very interesting conference, and there's going to be a big series of protests outside the front of that conference. So we'll chat to Sam shortly about what's going on with that conference and the protests outside.
Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
You're back with the Indie Media Show here on RTRFM 92.1 with your host, Alex Wisson. Very pleased to be joined on the line now by Sam Wainwright from Stop AUKUS WA. How are you, Sam?
Yeah, good morning. Well, thanks.
Excellent. Now, in preparing for this interview, Sam, I had a bit of a look at the Indian Ocean and Defence Security Conference website. Very slick. Very well presented, lovely. People clinking glasses of champagne and smiling and so forth. And it had a very polished sort of corporate presentation to it. And it promises a 3-day defence and manufacturing industry showcase where AUKUS meets the Quad. And also, on a slightly facetious note, although there's a sinister aspect to it as well, networking and hospitality, daily opportunities to meet, engage and grow your network. There's a sense in which when you have a look at that website, and I think it's not accidental, that it's just, you know, it's a harmless little coming together of industry representatives, manufacturing officials and government officials and so forth. So tell us, Sam, if you like, the true nature or the true reality of what lies behind this conference, which strikes me, as I said at the top of the show, a lot of people in Perth won't even know that this conference is going on. So for the benefit of our listeners, tell us what the Indian Ocean Defence Security Conference is all about.
Sure. Well, look, the conference is framed, I would say, by two things. One is that there's been a big push for over a decade and a half now, by both Labor and Liberal to make Australia a major weapons manufacturer, a world-leading exporter of weapons technology, arms and so forth. And we're already seeing that start to happen with significant arms exports to a country like Saudi Arabia. And then secondly, that is then coupled with this, Australia very much falling in behind what the US strategists call the pivot to Asia, which was begun under Obama, but has considered under subsequent US president to really launch Australia into a new Cold War, basically. So these two things come together with this conference. As the conference headline itself says, where AUKUS meets the Quad. And this conference is, it's not where the major decisions are made, but it's very much about trying to get Australian businesses the opportunity to leverage off all this massive defence expenditure, which is coming down the line. So there's not just the headline issue, of course, is AUKUS, the AUKUS submarines, $368 billion and counting, but there's a lot of other stuff as well. So we're getting closer to $500 billion by the time you add in the other missile defence systems, the new Navy ships, the fighters, drones and all the rest of it. So the conference, in a sense, embodies the kind of future that they want to create for Australia. And that is also borne out by the fact that towards the end of it, they've got a day where they're, or a session when they're inviting high school students to come along and consider a career in STEM and defence.
It's a bit of a crackly line, by the way, Sam. I don't know if you're in an awkward spot in terms of mobile phone reception, but if you could try to get somewhere with a clearer line. We can hear you okay, but it's a bit of a crackly line. But just on that last point you mentioned, and I used the word sinister before, we know that one of the talking points around AUKUS and one of the PR propaganda elements of promoting AUKUS was this notion that it's going to create jobs. And I saw that the Department of Jobs, Tourism, Science and Innovation of the Government of Western Australia is one of the sponsors of the conference. You mentioned, you know, this sort of expo element of bringing in high school kids. So talk to that, because it's, to be intellectual about it, it's a load of nonsense, really, isn't it? Just this idea that we should support AUKUS and submarine building because it's going to create, you know, thousands of jobs for West Australians somehow.
Yeah, well, this this invitation for students to attend a session towards the end of the conference is not the only thing we've seen. There's been other approaches made by other sections of state government to the state school system to get students thinking about jobs in STEM and linking that with defence. Of course, the idea that AUKUS is a good job creator is utterly ludicrous. Now, it's been a while since I did a sort of the back of the envelope sums, but they were talking about sort of 20,000 jobs and associated, you know, directly and indirectly. And if you look at the massive spend on AUKUS, that would actually constitute the least effective job creation program in the history of anything. When I did it, I think from memory it was about $16 million per job or something like that. In any case, with that sort of money, that is just the hundreds of billions of dollars that is being ploughed into AUKUS and other weapons of war, just imagine if that sort of money were going into confronting the climate crisis, the real existential crisis that we face, the real threat to Australia's future, which doesn't mean weapons, it means a rapid reorienting of our economy and society to face the threat of runaway global warming. Imagine the jobs in environmental repair, renewable energy, public transport, and also diverting more money into the care economy. All those things are jobs that we need and will create far more jobs than AUKUS does. I mean, you can understand why in a place like, say, Rockingham, where there's been a shortage of manufacturing jobs and people, you know, see some of the AUKUS money being, you know, splashed around and they go, well, it could mean jobs for me. But if you step back and look at it, it is the most, as I said at the outset, most inefficient job creation program in the history of anything.
And it's very unseemly, to put it mildly, that carrot is dangled, as you say, over a community like Rockingham that is, you know, starved of good employment opportunities for a lot of young people in particular. And yet this is viewed or is being purported as the kind of a viable alternative for those people. It's disgusting, really. You did mention, I think that's right, Sam, that there's probably not going to be great forward movement, so to speak, in terms of policy development at this conference. But to give the listeners a flavour of just what a big deal it is, particularly for a city like Perth, some of the speakers include former Defence Minister and Australian Ambassador to the United States, Kim Beazley, the Honourable Roger Cook, Premier, how nice that he's speaking. Governor Chris Dawson is opening the conference. Deputy Prime Minister Richard Marles will be there. Kurt Campbell, the US Deputy Secretary of State. A whole bunch of admirals and vice admirals from the UK and the US. So it is a big deal, isn't it? And again, not to be sort of facetious about it, but I attended the Eco-Socialism Conference a couple of weeks ago that you were involved in organising. And in some sense, this is almost like the ruling class equivalent of it. It's like a ruling class gabfest for all these, you know, representatives from government, from the military, and so on, you know, sort of come together for this talking fest.
That's right, and they really are working very hard. When I say they, I mean the federal government that's driving AUKUS and this war drive more generally, really are trying to pull the other streams of government, state and local government, universities, and of course businesses on board the AUKUS project and make everyone feel like they've got a stake in it politically, financially, and all the rest of it. So in addition to the trying to steer the minds of high school students towards STEM subjects and the defence industry, the universities have been drawn into it as well. So listeners would be familiar with the way, in a place like Western Australia, the fossil fuel industry is just totally sort of embedded and implicated in our universities and sponsors, you know, schools and, you know, provides, you know, funding for buildings and all this kind of thing. And we think nothing of a former, you know, mining executive being appointed as a vice chancellor of a university, as it happened at Murdoch University a few years ago. Well, the same thing is now happening with the university sector as well. So, the universities are becoming partners in the national, what's called the National AUKUS Workforce Alliance, which is a cooperation program between the universities Babcock and Huntington Ingalls Industries, which are US defense manufacturers, and both Babcock and Curtin University are like so-called platinum sponsors of this IODS. So that gives you a sense in which all of Australian civil society, they're attempting to pull into the AUKUS project. And just a bit of a tangent, the local governments in the southwest, so of Greater Perth, so Perth, Fremantle, East Fremantle, Rockingham, Kwinana, Rockingham, the mayors and CEOs of those local governments are all booked to go on a tour of US sort of Navy cities, defence installations, to talk about how local government, you know, prepares and adapts for the AUKUS project as well. So it's a big deal, that's for sure.
Mm. Now, we haven't got you on as a geostrategic analyst, so although having said that, you're something of an expert in these matters, in my opinion, but if we could drill down to, you know, why it's called the Indian Ocean Defence and Security Conference. If you read the website itself, there's a little spiel where it says, and I quote, "The Indian Ocean is where all of Australia's strategic interests converge, from preventing conflict and keeping sea lanes open to preserving the environment and supporting Australian business, but no single country can serve as its sole custodian." That's quite euphemistic language that, in my view, is really referring to the strategic and military architecture of that, you know, Western alliance in the Indian Ocean region. Finally got that out, of which Australia is a key part. So sort of expand on that, as Sam, we've had you on the show before, that really, if you read through this, the conference website, it's striking that they don't mention China, but really everything is about China, and it's about, you know, strengthening those military alliances, that military architecture in the Indian Ocean region, you know, as a bulwark against China ultimately, isn't it?
Yeah, look, that's right. Absolutely. I mean, this pivot to Asia that I said began under Obama and has been there's continuity between Obama and Trump and Biden on this question, and there will be in whoever is the next U.S. president as well. I mean, the U.S. ruling elite have essentially decided that they are going to block China's growth, not just its military growth, but its economic growth. And there's a funny paradox here because, you know, populist politicians like Trump like to bang on about how, you know, China has been stealing our jobs and all this sort of stuff. But we should never lose sight of the fact that it's US big business itself that very consciously decided to subcontract a part of its production chain to China because it was cheaper and they could make more money out of it. So it's certainly true that that process has created wealth in China and Chinese billionaires, but it's created even more money in the United States. But critically, the U.S. Wants to put limits on that. You know, the United States is happy enough for China to make components that's part of the production chain, like, you know, to make our washing machines and things like that. But the U.S. has decided very clearly it does not want China to become a world leader in AI. It does not want China to have a semiconductor industry. It does not want China to continue to industrialize and catch up to the West, and is prepared to go to war to achieve it. That's what this is about. We should never lose sight of that. You know, for all the, you know, huff and bluster about Chinese aggression, and I don't say this as someone who supports everything the Chinese government does or particularly supports the Chinese government, but it's actually the posture of the United States and its allies, including Australia, that is fundamentally aggressive. It's the United States and Australia that are seeking to encircle China militarily with an arc of bases and missile systems, and be able to turn off, block China's access to the world. So it's an extremely aggressive posture that the United States is taking. Australia's been dragged along with. That's what it all boils down to. I mean, these people are prepared to risk war, even nuclear war, to that end. And us in Soft AUKUS, we just say that can't happen. We have to oppose it.
Now, as you've already addressed, this conference speaks volumes, really, in terms of illustrating the connections, the nexus between corporate, state and military power. It's therefore unsurprising, given that nexus of power interest, that a whole kaleidoscope, and this is wonderful to see, a whole kaleidoscope of different protest groups are coming together, you know, to demonstrate their opposition to the conference agenda, including the Independent and Peaceful Australia Network, Unionists for Palestine, Stop AUKUS WA, obviously, Nuclear Free WA, the Greens, Friends of Palestine, WA and so on. So something of a convergence, if you like, of protest groups in this city. So tell us a little bit about, you know, some of the organising behind the protest. What's happening with, you know, with the protests outside the conference?
Yeah, sure. So look, there will be a launch protest, if you like, bright and early on Wednesday morning. So that's starting at 7:30 outside the convention centre. And that's hosted by all the groups that you mentioned. And we'll be taking up the various points of opposition to this, the agenda of the conference, basically, and the agenda of this whole war drive, which is both the risk of war, which I've mentioned before, the fact that we have one chance to stop runaway global warming, and if we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on a new cold war, we're simply not doing it. And then there's also the question of nuclear risk as well. So because, as you mentioned, the Nuclear Free WA is a sponsor of that Wednesday morning protest as well, because we will, AUKUS means having nuclear reactors 50 kilometres from the centre of Perth at Garden Island. Nuclear reactors have 4 to 5 times as much radioactive material as the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And of course, more immediately, there'll be low-level radioactive waste as well. So that and other things will be drawn out. On the Thursday at lunchtime, there's also going to be a protest organised by Students for Palestine, specifically targeting Rafael Systems, an Israeli arms manufacturer that is present at the conference as well. So I encourage people to get along to both events. Because Australia has decided to really launch itself down the path of being a major weapons manufacturer, that inevitably also means that these Australian weapons manufacturing companies get integrated with the Israeli weapons manufacturing ecosystem as well, because Israel is a leading weapons manufacturer and very much inserted into the Western, weapons manufacturing sort of system as well. So it also connects to the genocide that's going into Palestine. So for all those reasons, risk of war, waste of money, the genocide in Palestine, nuclear reactors 50 k's from the centre of Perth, all of them bundled together are a good reason to come down to the protest.
Sam Wainwright from Stop AUKUS WA, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for the time.
Yeah, and I encourage our listeners to get down there if you can this Wednesday morning, 7:30 a.m. outside the Perth Convention and Exhibition Centre, and then the following day, midday. It's a very important conference, and it's sort of striking, actually. I was thinking about that interview, how little coverage it gets in the mainstream media. I mean, I'm a bit of a broken record on this front, unapologetically so, that it's shameful, actually. It's a real indictment of what passes for our journalism in this state, that there's this huge, strategically important conference and nary a word about it. I'm sure there'll be glowing accounts of it later in the week in The Worst Australian. It's just gone past 11:30. You're listening to the Indie Media Show here on RTRFM 92.1, The Sound Alternative.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
Now, as I said at the top of the show, there's obviously been a huge brouhaha within the Victorian branch of the construction division of the CFMEU. I'll go through a little bit of it briefly in terms of my particular take on it for what it's worth. The first and obvious thing to say, and one has to be honest about this, is that clearly, newsflash, there's been corruption in the construction industry. I stress the word industry. For decades, anyone who thinks some of the stuff covered in the Channel 9 60 Minutes Fairfax Media reporting was somehow revelatory just simply hasn't been paying attention. The bosses at the top end of the town, enormously corrupt. I mean, we just have to look at this state for the love of God. It's basically run by Multiplex and these big construction companies as well as the mining companies, and the notion that isn't manifestly corrupt just because something's so in your face and so blatant doesn't mean it's not a form of corruption. I think a lot of people misunderstand that. So there's enormous institutionalised corruption across the industry involving billions and billions of dollars, multimillionaires and billionaires doing dodgy deals all the time. Now, does some of that corruption, if you like, trickle down to affect, the byproduct of involving some union officials when there's so much money at stake? You can draw the analogy with police, and the police are a bad institution in society for lots of ways. But in terms of police corruption, one of the reasons is police corruption is because there's so much money involved in crime that there's enormous temptation to take some of that money. And I think that's probably true as well for some people in the construction union. The point is that one of the points is that to malign all union leaders and organisers and officials, employees, lump them in that corrupt basket is defamatory, is disgusting, is unfounded, it's just empirically not verified or verifiable. So forget that, because that's really what's being done here in terms of the Channel 9 agenda. I mean, that's sort of so obvious one that barely needs to mention it. The Channel 9 ruling class agenda here is to use this so-called corruption scandal as a battering ram against the Victorian branch of the construction division of the CFMU, which, coincidentally enough, is probably the strongest, most militant union branch anywhere in the country. Like, what a happy coincidence for the building industry bosses and the Albanese government and the corporate media that they happen to be going after the most militant union branch. So it's sort of a nonsense in that sense. So there's two things: is there some corruption? I'd be very surprised if there wasn't, really. But should we defend good, militant, principled trade unionists, against government attacks and corporate attacks 100% in a heartbeat without a moment's hesitation? So a bit of a walk and chew gum at the same time type of argument. And I will say on the critical side for sort of a lot of my left-wing friends and comrades out there, a more general comment actually about the dynamic of the way people think, particularly on social media, that there's, I think, quite a troubling, very simplistic binary dynamic to the way people respond to a media story like this, which is to say, John Setka, the former Victorian secretary of the CFMU, who resigned ahead of the 60 Minutes story, there's this sort of, and I understand where it comes from, a temptation for a lot of people on the left and in the Labor movement to suddenly pretend that John Setka was an irreproachable angel without fault. Why? Well, because Channel 9 saying he's a demon, therefore he must be an angel. So there is a certain kind of insincerity, I'd go as far as to say dishonesty, in that kind of argument. Again, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. It's not that difficult. There may well have been some corruption, among his officials. I don't, and I'm being careful in saying that, by the way, because there's no charges laid and nothing's been proven. But the point is, you can actually speculate as to the possibility of there being some elements of corruption, while also 100% defending to the death, even, someone like John Setka, I would defend to the death, actually, and I'm not joking, against, government and corporate attacks. So there's a set of principles there that I think people need to iron out, and it's a question of having open and honest, discussions about this stuff. Anyway, I hadn't intended to sort of quite go through all of that, but I think it's important for anyone who cares about the trade union movement, the labour movement, in this country. But what I was really leading up to was an introduction to one from our archives, which I think it's a great interview to play. There's been a lot of mention of the Builders Labours Federation, the legendary Builders Labours Federation, in relation to this CFMU brouhaha. Now, they were attacked and eventually deregistered by the Hawke government in the 1980s, and with good reason, because they were a threat to ruling class power, none more so than at the height of their power in the 1970s. When they famously imposed green bans on various places around Sydney, including Centennial Park, the heritage area of the Rocks, and Kelly's Bush. And it was a little while back now that Ray Grenfell, our colleague, had the opportunity to speak to Professor Verity Bergman, co-author of Green Bans, Red Union, Environmental Activism, the New South Wales Builders Labours Federation. It was upon the passing, actually, of Jack Mundy's death, who was the leader of the BLF there in New South Wales, and pioneered these green bans. And we'll bring you that interview now.
Now, you may remember last week we spoke of the passing of Jack Mundy, leader of the New South Wales branch of the Builders Labourers Federation, member of the Communist Party of Australia. On first blush, hearing that bio, one might take him to be an obscure figure, a man of little consequence, yet he played a monumental role in post-war Australian history. And his impact on modern environmental politics is arguably without parallel. As I said, Mundy passed away earlier this month, and we now have the opportunity to speak to Professor Verity Bergman, Adjunct Professor of Politics in the School of Social Sciences at Monash University and co-author of Green Bans, Red Union, Environmental Activism and the New South Wales Builders Labourers Federation. Thanks very much for joining us today, Verity.
You're very welcome.
Now, a big question to begin with, Professor Bergman, but particularly for the benefit of our younger listeners, let's start with who was Jack Mundy? What was his background and how did he come to play such a prominent role in Australian political life?
Well, he was a working class boy who grew up on the Atherton Tableland in far north Queensland, where he learned to love nature and resent the, you know, developers encroaching on the space. In 1951, Parramatta Rugby League Club talent scouts enticed him to Sydney. So he moved down there and experienced environmental shock. He noticed that his young son was having respiratory problems from industrial pollution in Western Sydney, that the CBD was becoming more and more dominated by high-rise buildings, sun shining on fewer streets, and he became very concerned about how developers were just doing what they wanted to increase their profits and nobody was stopping them. The coalition government was very much in the hands of developers, and in those days there wasn't legislation that could protect valuable old buildings or stop green spaces being, you know, cleared to make way for luxury, you know, developments and so on. And he became secretary of the New South Wales Builders Labourers Federation in 1968 and developed a new concept of unionism, as he called it, and that included a commitment to the social responsibility of labour, that the workers had a right to insist that their labour not be used in harmful ways. Mm. So this is how really the Green Bands movement developed, when the builders' labourers were persuaded that they had to stop the terrible destruction that was taking place. And so, you know, when resident activists who had unsuccessfully tried to stop terrible things happening turned to the people who were employed to start the demolition, and those people had a social conscience and refused to do it, that's how the Green Bands movement started.
Certainly, and there's a lot of places in Sydney that will forever be linked with the BLF and Jack Mundy, places such as Centennial Park, Kelly's Bush, The Rocks, and so many, many more. You've already touched on it there, and I guess we don't have time to go into the history in great detail, and we certainly encourage all of our listeners to learn more of the history by getting a copy of your book.
And there's a second edition, 2017, and the subtitle is The Saving of a City.
Awesome. But and I guess that largely deals with the Green Bands and their function. But how did Mundy come to build such a powerful coalition in defence of these green spaces and the heritage architecture in Sydney? I mean, it's often joked about, for instance, that the burly working class men of the BLF and the upper middle class women campaigning to save Kelly's Bush made for very strange political bedfellows, yet it proved to be an enormously effective alliance. And did Mundy himself have a gift for creating such relationships, or does it say something more about the political atmosphere of this time?
He had a huge capacity to build alliances. He called it this winning alliance. And how he did it was that he would say, he would persuade the workers to take a total view. You know, what is the use of fighting for higher wages and better conditions, you know, if you choke to death in polluted and planless cities? And he emphasised that it was workers that suffered disproportionately from environmental problems. So they had the most at stake. They had the greatest interest in better urban planning. And also he would stress that, and we are the people that can actually stop the destruction. And then the middle class, if you like, you know, environmental activists could see that they had been powerless to stop the destruction. It was only if they linked up with, you know, the working class activists, who they would not normally have had anything to do with, that this powerful winning alliance could actually achieve extraordinary things. And over 5 years, prevent so much destruction. And because of that powerful combination, they were able then to make governments respond to the challenge, so that governments then improved the heritage and environmental legislation. And it also changed the culture of town planning because people could see that what they were doing was so much better. I mean, The Rocks would have been a high-rise concrete and glass jungle. The oldest buildings in the country would have been lost. It just would have been a disaster. And of course, I mean, tourism would have suffered. It's, you know, millions of people go there each year. They wouldn't have gone to go and see concrete and glass skyscrapers.
Certainly. Now, again, unfortunately, we don't have time to go into too much detail here, Professor Bergman, but it's worth mentioning that Monday's New South Wales BLF wasn't just devoted to environmental causes. It also, for instance, lent its support to the early phase of the gay rights movement years before the first Mardi Gras, and certainly a long time before virtually any other trade union. Can you, I guess, expand on that for our listeners a little bit, and the BLF's involvement in perhaps what's called the pink bands at the time?
Yes, at Macquarie University, a residential college expelled a gay activist, and the New South Wales BLF announced a ban on construction work that was going on at Macquarie University, and this forced the University Council to ensure that that student was reinstated to his residential college. There was also a ban at Sydney University when the professorial board tried to stop the first women's studies course going ahead. And so they banned construction work at Sydney University, and sure enough, the women's studies course went ahead. And in Redfern, they helped the local Aboriginal community there resist a developer by, you know, refusing to be involved in the work. And that then formed the basis of the Redfern Aboriginal Community Housing Scheme.
It certainly paints an incredible picture, doesn't it, that, you know, that a union can be so involved in social, environmental and economic justice issues outside of perhaps what's now considered, you know, the self-interest of some unions. And Mundy had a great political legacy himself, and perhaps least known about his legacy is his impact on environmental activism, in the sense that even the great Petra Kelly, founder of the German Greens, took inspiration from the BLF Green Bands, and even our own Bob Brown has also credited his influence. What can you say about that, that broader sort of political influence of someone such as Jack Mundy?
Yes, that's right. Petra Kelly visited Sydney during the Green Bands and was so impressed about this winning alliance between environmentalists and workers with power at the point of production, that when she went back to Germany, she decided that the Greens was the name to call her, you know, German political party. And so that was how the word green then spreads around the world and becomes associated with environmental politics. But she got the word, really, from Green Bands. And Jack had coined the term Green Band in February 1973. They were originally called Black Bands, which is the normal word when, you know, workers refuse to work on something. But Jack argued that Green Band was a better terminology because it expressed, you know, greenness, nature, etc., and had more positive connotations than a normal union Black Band. So, in a way, he helped invent the word green.
Certainly.
And what it means.
Now, finally, Professor Bergman, we're living in incredible times with issues such, of course, with the COVID-19 pandemic, but more broadly, the pressing issue of climate change and the activism that's arisen around that. We've had, you know, the huge student strike movement. We've had things such as the Extinction Rebellion and so forth, and there's increasingly environmental movements, but unfortunately, with some notable exceptions, the trade union movements still seem to be somewhat absent from these environmental campaigns, at least in the sense in comparing them to the BLF and the Green Bands and so forth. Now, of course, you know, it's a difficult question, and I can't imagine anyone being able to answer it, but do you see any of these sorts of links that Jack Mundy was so you know, renowned for, the links between environmental movements and unions? Do you see them forming again now, or do you see any sort of potential for that kind of coalition and the kind of politics and legacy of the BLF and Jack Mundy?
They have always been there. In 1992, the Australian Council of Trade Unions put out a 32-page pamphlet about, you know, the greenhouse effect and how important it was that Australia move to a low-carbon economy, and that in doing so, this would ensure sustainable, plentiful jobs into the future. And, you know, they've always been sort of formally committed to that sort of project. Unfortunately, some particular unions that are very, very closely linked to fossil fuel extraction and so on tend to sort of capture, get the publicity. And so in the public mind, people think that the union movement, you know, doesn't care. It's absolutely wrong. And internationally, the Just Transition movement has been developing through international trade union networks, which makes the important point that workers can't be expected to not only be the people most likely to suffer the consequences of climate change, but also in when it comes to mitigating climate change, also be the first to suffer. The society has to ensure, as we did during, you know, the COVID pandemic, that people who, for public health reasons, get stood down should be supported so that workers don't fear job loss from environmental legislation. And they shouldn't need to because, as Jack Mundy always said, just to repair the damage already done the planet will require millions of jobs. So he wanted to explode that myth, and he called it a myth, and it is a myth, that environmental protection costs jobs. And so for him, the important thing was for workers to be committed to environmental protection and for environmentalists to be committed to preserving and protecting workers' livelihoods, that if environmental policies threaten jobs, then those workers had to be supported to find jobs that were just as good in industries that were good for the planet.
Professor Verity Bergman there, who was the co-author of Green Bands, Red Unions, Environmental Activism of the New South Wales Builders Labours Federation, talking to Ray Grenfell a few years back. And yeah, as I said in the introduction to that interview, pretty apposite timely stuff given the attacks on the CFMEU. Time now for a bit of editorial comment about the big news story, which is obviously Biden stepping down as Democratic presidential nominee. It's wild times, isn't it? Obviously, we had the attempted assassination of Trump last week, and now this news with Biden. He's the first incumbent president in more than 50 years to step down during the race. So one of the more famous examples is, well, actually, it's not quite the right example. Lyndon Baines Johnson refused to or declined to go through the re-election campaign. There are a few other examples throughout history, but it's pretty rare. As I said at the top of the show, you know, you get some of the hilarious hot takes in the immediate wake of this kind of news. It was the same with the attempted assassination of Trump. It was literally within minutes there were conspiracy theories breaking out. Similarly, we're seeing some really silly hot takes. I mentioned Rachel Maddow, rather embarrassingly saying of Biden, what a man, what a patriot, what an act of selfless devotion to your country. Seen plenty of other comments, obsequious, you know, pretty silly comments from congressmen and so forth along the same line. So we can rule that out immediately, any notion that he's done this sort of selflessly when he's just absolutely been, you know, to the very brink before he's had to resign. He was kept pushing and pushing. And indeed, there's going to be a question mark whether or not the full story of, you know, how much he's been pushed, you know, by his own staffers, by people like Pelosi and Obama and all the rest of it. The notion that he's sort of done this willingly, I think, is again, pretty silly. But yeah, I mean, moving on to what this means for the election in November, as I already sort of mentioned as well at the top of the show, by no means a done deal that the Vice President Kamala Harris will be the nominee. She's of Jamaican and Indian descent, and I mention that because, and I'm not being cynical about this, I mean, this is absolutely the case, it's a serious point, is that one of the very few and arguably the only card, that Trump card, you know, a much used pun, that the Democrats still have available to them is identity politics. So, oh, isn't it wonderful? She's a woman of colour, you know, Jamaican Indian descent, you go girl, etc. Now, we've seen that playbook before, and that's one of the reasons why I think it won't work this time. Obviously, we saw the hope and change candidacy of Barack Guantanamo Bay Obama, who murdered thousands of civilians in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and authorized the murder of American citizens by predator drones, the warmonger, the corporate lapdog Barack Obama. Hope and change, hope and change. Well, he's a man of colour, and look how that worked out for working class African Americans. Not very well at all. And then there was the echo of that, where already then it was becoming, you know, first as tragedy, then as farce, you know, sort of comical already with this bizarre attempt to rehabilitate and remould the image of Hillary Rodham Clinton, a lifelong servant of corporate power, a lifelong hawk, a lifelong warmonger. somebody who's absolutely, you cannot be more embedded in the corporate political establishment in the United States than Hillary Clinton, from a dynastic family. Her husband was president, for heaven's sake. And yet, the Democratic National Committee, in their infinite wisdom, thought that they could, you know, palm off this corporate warmonger as a progressive candidate. And I mean, even just enunciating the sentence, you sort of realise just the absurdity of it, on the basis that she was a human female. Like, literally, that was the whole basis of her appeal, was that she was a woman. And it didn't work. I mean, famously, it didn't work. Despite all the hysterics, it's the equivalent of the great steal of the election, by the way, is Russiagate. People don't talk about that anymore, and everyone lampooned and made fun of Republican supporters for thinking that the 2020 election was stolen, forgetting somehow that millions of Democrat supporters and foolish liberals said exactly the same thing about the 2016 election, that it was somehow stolen by Russia. Why did they go with that hysterical theory that has absolutely no evidence for it whatsoever? Because they couldn't face the fact, I mean, this is an embarrassment factor actually, they couldn't face the fact that this brilliant strategy of putting forward a candidate purely on the basis of being a female didn't work against Donald Trump. I mean, who would have thought? So I mention all that because it's, you know, some people might say third time's a charm. I would say third time's just is just sort of a ridiculous farce. If they try and play that card again, Kamala Harris, woman of colour, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful and exciting to have a woman of colour with her fingers on the nuclear button, authorising the US military to oppress people and murder people throughout the world? Wouldn't that be great? I mean, I just don't know that will fly anymore. And I could be wrong about that. I mean, clearly the youth vote is crucial. The African-American vote, you know, is I don't want to say rusted onto the Democrats. And in fact, it's a lot of it is peeling away towards the Republicans. And among Hispanic men, Trump is leading. And the fact is, Trump has, you know, a pretty healthy lead in five of the six swing states that will be crucial. So the youth vote, the 18 to 29, are they more susceptible to these, you know, pretty sort of nasty, you know, transparently manipulative arguments around identity politics? Maybe. I think, you know, we've probably gone past peak identity politics with that sort of stuff, the politics of so-called representation. I could be wrong. I mean, I don't think that Kamala Harris is going to win the election. Is my final statement with that. Now, the other possibility, of course, is that there are groups like the Young Turks, who and other, you know, sort of on the left of the Democrats pushing for what's known as an open convention, which means there would be an open contestation on the conference floor at the Democratic National Convention next month, which could throw up, you know, all kinds of wild cards, whether it be, you know, California Governor Gavin Newsom. There's even this sort of, you know, I think, very remote, pretty stupid sort of speculation. Well, Bernie Sanders could come in through the back door. No, that won't happen. But so that's possible as well. That'll be an open ticket. Already in the news this morning, Pelosi and I think also Biden haven't endorsed Harris. So that's kind of noteworthy as well. Some of those key power brokers haven't come fully behind Harris, perhaps cognizant of the fact that, you know, I don't think it really any better prospect to win than Biden was. So there'll be probably a little bit of a, you know, sugar hit, as they say, in the polls for Harris. But will she win against Trump? No, I really think that's unlikely. But we shall see. You know, there's still nearly 4 months to go, after all, and plenty could happen. Look at what's just happened in the past couple of weeks, after all. That's about all we have time for here in the Indie Media Show. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Sam Wainwright for coming on the show. And do get down to that Indian Ocean Defence Security Conference if you can, Wednesday, 7:30 a.m. Outside the Perth Convention Centre. We'll be back next week, of course. But stay tuned for the news, and then out to lunch with Rhiann Todhunter. I'm going to go out with a little bit of Beaverloop. This is Buy Me a Phoney. And as we say every week, don't hate the media. Become the media.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station.
You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.